Today is July 4th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. Also on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5, New York on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are different. Tonight, WBAI is on a membership drive. This was covered a few weeks ago, but it is worth repeating. There is a website, www.haveibeenpwned.com. You enter your email address and it will determine what dark web group may have your email address. You can also enter your password. The entry itself is encrypted and it will check to see if the password is in the library stored in the dark web. If it exists in the dark web, change the password and make sure it is unique. The dark web has this massive library of passwords that is used for brute force hacking. With the start of summer, many travelers are planning to travel by plane. TSA has put new restrictions on powder-based items. The Transportation Security Administration began scrutinizing containers of powders in flyers' carry-on bags as part of a broader security push and will soon ask foreign airports that send flights directly to the United States to do the same. The focus is on containers holding at least 350 milliliters of powder, which is about the size of a can of soda. TSA and airlines are going to step up awareness of efforts about the change, urging passengers to pack larger containers in checked luggage and remove smaller containers from carry-on bags for separate screening, similar to small containers of liquids. And starting now, TSA will request foreign airports with non-stop U.S. flights to match the effort, much as it did last summer when we began requiring passengers to remove electronics larger than cell phones from carry-on bags for separate screening. The security effort isn't a ban, but the risk for a traveler returning with large containers of Moroccan spice in a carry-on bag rather than checked luggage is that a checkpoint officer could force the person to throw away a suspicious powder before boarding the plane. For ease of travel, TSA recommends placing larger items in checked baggage prior to arriving at the security checkpoint. The international aviation community and industry actions represent collaborative approaches that greatly enhance global aviation security. The main security concern is from improvised explosives, but TSA is also concerned about pepper spray and other materials in the cabin. TSA says powders can include items like cosmetics, baby powder, and protein or energy powder mixes, among others. Gunpowder remains prohibited from all checked or carry-on luggage. We encourage people to divest certain items, said TSA, especially organic items, in order to get a clearer view of what's going on inside the bag. It's something that they advise people to do, and they're asking foreign partners to do the same, and the effort is another example of tightening aviation security. Airport checkpoint security was federalized under TSA after the terrorist hijacking of 9/11 and has become stricter in recent years with the development of non-metallic explosive. In September of 2006, restricting containers of liquids, gels, and aerosols to 3.3 ounces in carry-on bags was begun to foil transatlantic bomb plots. In March of 2010, installing full-body scanners at checkpoints that can detect unusual objects beneath a traveler's clothing. The effort to detect non-metallic explosive came after the underwear bomber tried to detonate an improvised explosive device on a plane from Amsterdam to Detroit in December of 2009. In July 2017, TSA required travelers to remove all electronics larger than cell phones from carry-on bags for screening after intelligence revealed terrorists trying to hide bombs in laptops. More recently, travelers noticed more security of food in carry-on bags this spring at TSA checkpoints. The challenge for security officials is to get a good look at objects in sometimes cluttered carry-on bags. Rather than ban snacks or containers of powders, TSA is asking travelers to remove them from carry-on bags for a better view in the X-ray machines. The alternative is to risk a hand search of the bag, which slows down the traveler and the whole line. Everyday items, including some foods, books and magazines, powders, and large electronics, may result in additional screening. Smart home security camera sends footage to wrong person. Internet-connected devices are known for having their fair share of security issues, especially when it comes to cameras. But here's a new one. The BBC reported this week that a smart home security camera started sending video clips to the wrong person. One of the BBC staffers or employees purchased an internet-enabled camera made by Swan, that's S-W-A-N-N, Communications, and started receiving video footage that showed the inside of someone else's home. The company claims the problem is a one-off occurrence, but there's been at least one other instance of the same problem. The BBC staffer reportedly first purchased her security camera in December and didn't have any issues with it until last week, when she started getting notifications from the device. The Swan camera typically alerts the user when it detects movement. When the staffer contacted Swan about the issue during the weekend, she was told nothing could be done about the issue until Monday. Once it was finally addressed by the company staff, the staffer stopped receiving clips from the unrelated camera. Why exactly did the mix-up happen? A spokesperson for Swan told the BBC the issue was a result of a human error. All cameras are given a security key which allows the device to securely transmit footage from the camera to a Swan server and be retrieved on a smartphone on or other device. In this case, two cameras were given the same security key, which resulted in the footage being sent to the BBC staffer. Swan also blamed the family, of course, the staffer, noting that they ignored a warning prompt that informed them that the camera was already paired to another account. But at the end of the day, the issue stemmed from Swan producing duplicate keys, not the family failing to understand the company's mistake. On Twitter, another user reportedly received footage from a pub. Swan said he was investigating the situation, but claimed that the issue was likely the result of both the pub and the Twitter user registered their products with the same username and password. Hey, if that was the case, it should have been rejected. That explanation seems a little bit suspicious. More than suspicious. You shouldn't be able to register a device with a username that's already in use, for one. And even if that is possible, what are the odds that a person selects the exact same login information as someone else, as well as the same password? That just doesn't compute. One way or another, it seems like Swan's quality control really needs a review. And my recommendation? I would stay away from the product until they get it resolved. But it is not a user problem. It is a manufacturer problem. And products like this don't deserve to be on the market. The European Union has taken the first step in passing controversial copyright law that could very well censor the entire internet. The legislation passed on initial vote, but it will need the overall parliamentary approval before it becomes law. On June the 20th, the European Union's Legal Affairs Committee, called JURI, J-U-R-I, voted in favor of the legislation called the Copyright Directive. Although most of the directive simply updates technical language for copyright law in the age of the internet, it includes two highly controversial provisions. These are Article 11, which is a link tax, which would force online platforms like Facebook and Google to buy licenses from media companies before linking to their stories. And Article 13, an upload filter, which will require that everything uploaded online in the European Union is checked for copyright infringement. That is an almost impossible task as it's huge. European Union lawmakers critical of legislation say these articles may have been proposed with good intentions, like protecting copyright owners, but were so vaguely worded and it's ripe for abuse. The methods to address the issue are catastrophic and will hurt the people they want to protect. Both Article 11 and Article 13 were approved by the jury committee, but won't become official legislation until it's passed by the entire European Parliament in a plenary vote. There's no definite timetable for when such a vote might be taking place, but it's likely to happen between December of this year and the first half of next year. The executive director of the Digital Rights Association, EDRI, said that the outcome of the jury decision was extremely disappointing. There are signs that the growing backlash against the legislation is having, well, it's having an effect. However, it's not just a plenary vote by the European Parliament that will decide the fate of the copyright directive. Currently, the legislation is also set to be debated in what is known as trilogue negotiations, closed-door negotiations between EU legislatures and member states. These are intended to speed up the process of adopting new laws. But critics say they are opaque and undemocratic. Whether or not the copyright directive will be subject to such negotiation is undecided. If the legislation is passed in its current form, it would have a devastating effect. Article 13, for example, would require the creation of an automatic filter for all online content uploaded in the European Union, checking it against a database of copyright licenses. The system would be costly to create, impossible to keep up to date, and easily gamed by copyright trolls. And as many experts says, including Tim Berners-Lee and Jimmy Wales have warned, it will turn the internet into a tool for automated surveillance and control of its users. That the copyright directive has passed its first legislative hurdle without amendment is obviously disheartening. Hopefully, people's views are heard when it comes to the final vote. Tim Berners-Lee, the man who created the World Wide Web, has some regrets in a recent interview with Vanity Fair. Berners-Lee has seen his creation debased by everything from fake news to mass surveillance, but he's got a plan to fix it. For people who want to make sure the web serves humanity, we have to concern ourselves with what people are building on top of it. Berners-Lee was speaking about the future of the internet. Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. Back in 1989, he came up with the idea that eventually became the web. Initially, Berners-Lee innovation was intended to help scientists share data across a then obscure platform called the internet, a version of which the US government had been using since the 1960s. His decision to release the source code for free to make the web an open and democratic platform for all quickly took on a life of its own. He was named one of the 20th century most important figures by Time magazine and received the Turing Award. He had also been knighted by the Queen of England. Berners-Lee, who never directly profited off his invention, has also spent most of his life trying to guard it. Berners-Lee had spent the past three decades thinking about little else from the beginning. In fact, Berners-Lee understood how the epic power of the web would radically transform governments, businesses, societies, and he also envisioned that his invention could, in the wrong hands, become a destroyer of worlds. "I was devastated," said Berners-Lee as he records his reaction to the web's recent abuses. He's now working on a new software, Solid, to reclaim the web from corporations and return it to its democratic roots. Berners-Lee said, "We demonstrated that the web had failed instead of serving humanity, as it was supposed to have done, and failed in many places. The increasing centralization has ended up producing, with no deliberate action of the people who designed the platform, a large-scale emergent phenomenon which is still anti-human. What made the web powerful and ultimately dominant, however, would also one day prove to be its greatest vulnerability. Berners-Lee gave it away for free. Anyone with a computer and an internet connection could not only access it but also build off of it. Berners-Lee understood that the web needed to be unfettered by patents, fees, royalties, and any other controls in order to thrive. This way, millions of innovators could design their own products to take advantage of it. And of course, millions did. Computer scientists and academics picked it up first, building applications that then drew others. The spirit there was very decentralized. The individual was incredibly empowered. It was all based on their having no central authority that you had to go to ask permission. That feeling of individual control, that empowerment, is something we've lost. He also said the power of the web wasn't taken or stolen. We collectively, by the billions, gave it away with every signed user agreement and intimate moment shared with technology. Facebook, Google, and Amazon now monopolize almost everything that happens online, from what we buy to the news we read to who we like. Also, with a handful of powerful government agencies, they're able to monitor, manipulate, and spy in once unimaginable ways. The idea is simple. Re-decentralize the web. Working with a small team of developers, Berners-Lee has spent most of his time now on Solid, a platform designed to give individuals, rather than corporations, control of their own data. There are people working in the lab trying to imagine how the web could be different, how society on the web could look different, what could happen if we give people privacy and we give people control of their data. They're building a whole new ecosystem. AT&T is slipping a fast one on you with an extra $1.23 onto your wireless bill. Former employees call out AT&T for unethical business practices that push customers to sign up for various streaming TV packages, sometimes without their knowledge or explicit consent. But now it seems things may have gotten even worse. It seems that AT&T's new strategy to increase revenue is by upping the administrative fees, of course we don't know what that means, tacked on to monthly phone bills from 76 cents to $1.99. While that might not sound like much, multiply that by 12 months a year and you're looking a lot more than just chump change itself. Anyone on a traditional postpaid plan will be subject to the increased fees, while prepaid accounts will be spared for now. In addition to AT&T's new increased administrative fees, they also introduced new unlimited wireless plans that were first to take advantage of AT&T's merger with Time Warner, that has now since been renamed Warner Media, by offering free subscriptions to its new Watch TV service. However, hidden among the fine print for AT&T's new Unlimited and More plan was a $5 monthly price hike for customers with a single line when compared to AT&T's existing Unlimited Choice Enhanced plan. And even though other versions of AT&T's Unlimited and More plans feature rates that stay the same, all these sneaky little changes mean that anyone on AT&T should take a real close look at their bill and make sure that the figures haven't jumped up without your knowledge. Dr. Alfred Poor has some fascinating information about wearable and health technologies. Research results show benefits of artificial pancreas systems for diabetics. Deaths from falls continue to rise for U.S. seniors. And finally, a soft fabric exoskeleton can help people stand and walk.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
As you're no doubt aware, diabetes is a chronic condition in which your body is not able to regulate the levels of sugar in your blood. Glucose is the kind of sugar in your blood, so it's your blood glucose level that's of concern. Patients with diabetes have a problem because their pancreas, which is an organ in the body, is no longer able to produce insulin, proper amounts, in response to fluctuating rates of blood sugar levels. And that's why you have to measure your blood sugar and then adjust the dose of insulin that you inject yourself with. It's inconvenient, but it's also difficult to maintain your blood sugar levels accurately. The big problem there is if your blood sugar levels vary too high or too low, it can cause secondary health problems, ranging from blindness to circulatory problems that can lead to sores and even limb amputations. So it's really important to help patients maintain their proper level of blood sugar. We've talked a lot about continuous glucose monitors. These are devices that you can actually wear on your body that will continuously measure your blood sugar levels. And there are also insulin pumps that will automatically administer the correct dose. The interesting thing is the new hybrid closed-loop systems pair the data from a continuous glucose monitor with the output of the insulin pump. So it becomes essentially an artificial pancreas that maintains your blood sugar level for you. A recent study based on equipment from Medtronic shows just how effective these new closed hybrid systems can be. They did a study involving more than 32,000 users, accumulated more than 2 million patient days of data. What they discovered was that the patients using the system stayed within the optimal blood glucose range an average of 70% of the time. That's huge. That's more than 40% better than the average of the patients in the same study who self-administered their insulin doses. So this is an incredible improvement. Also, more than 85% of the patients in the study reported higher quality of life using the system. Not only did they find that this was better initially when they started using the system, but actually their quality of life improved over the research period as they became more comfortable with the device. So this is really interesting and important data. It demonstrates clearly what we would assume might be true, but that these systems can replace the normal function of the pancreas to a large degree, can help patients maintain their blood glucose levels even when they're sleeping, which is a big problem for patients who have to administer their own insulin. And it shows that these wearable digital health devices really can make a huge difference in the lives of patients. There's a cause of death for seniors 65 and older in the United States that results in more than 30,000 deaths every year. In fact, the number has been growing over the past 10 years or so. According to research by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, in 2007, 47 out of 100,000 seniors died from this. By 2016, that rate had increased from 47 per 100,000 to 61 per 100,000. So that's almost a 50% increase. That's a huge growth. And so you would think this would be some sort of a disease that we'd want to solve as quickly and effectively as we can. Well, the fact is, this is not a disease per se. The cause of death is actually unintentional injuries, and the majority of which occurred from a fall. Just a simple fall. The problem is with seniors, if they're unsteady on their feet and if they fall, they're likely to break bones, have significant injuries, and these lead to secondary complications. They put more strain on their heart and lungs and other body systems. They may not recover well, which means they lose mobility, which cascades into a whole series of different kinds of complications and chronic conditions that can result from all this. So the bottom line here is the risk of falling for seniors is significant and is a real health concern. So doctors need to spend more time working with their patients, making sure that they're living in a safe environment and assessing them for risk of falling. There's all kinds of wearable devices and other techniques that are being used now to try to understand the walking gait of a senior and be able to look and evaluate it and decide just what level of risk they have of falling. And then there's all kinds of things you can do around the home to remove stumbling and tripping hazards, to add handrails in key places like the bathroom, so that seniors can steady themselves and avoid the risk of falling. Instead of rising, we should be able to cut down on the rate of these fall injuries for seniors. and improve the health for many of them. If you've been listening to these segments over the years, you may realize that I'm a big fan of exoskeletons. These are devices that are worn on the outside of the body to compensate for the loss of physical strength on the part of a patient. A lot of people, when they think of exoskeletons, think of sort of robotic armor that you place yourself inside and it provides power assist to help you move around and to lift things and so forth. It's a popular theme in many science fiction movies. Well, you don't need to walk around in a suit of armor to benefit from exoskeleton technology. SMS is a research group in Zurich, Switzerland, and they've created what they call the MAX, Mobility Assisting Textile Exoskeleton. And the key word there is textile. Instead of creating rigid metal and plastic panels and limbs and joints and levers and actuators and so forth, this device relies on textiles, smooth, soft, flexible devices. The system has sensors for different points on the body, such as joints and muscles and so forth, and so it's able to sense when the wearer is trying to do something like walk or stand up or get out of a wheelchair or so forth. And it then takes that intention signal and transmits it to a controller that then signals the actuators to assist that intended motion. So the forces generated by the exoskeleton work in conjunction with the existing bones and joints and other components of the patient's limbs, rather than relying on a whole new external structure. It's a new approach to mobility, providing a power assist to help patients with limited mobility or possibly even help paralyzed patients walk again. It's another case where exoskeletons are demonstrating great possibilities for future improvement in the quality of life of patients around the world.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Larry O'Connor started Otherworld Computing in 1988 when he was still in high school. The company began as a printer ribbon re-inking business, and O'Connor started it in his family's barn in rural Illinois. In just 1 year from inception, the company moved out of the barn and into the first office space, hiring its first employees, and today OWC, which stands for Otherworld Computing, is one of the leading suppliers of technology product upgrades and accessories.
Hello, my name is Larry O'Connor. I'm from Otherworld Computing, MacSales.com. It's my pleasure today to talk about upgrading your Macintosh. Now, one of the best things about a Macintosh, about actually pretty much everything that Apple builds, is how long these systems last. Having said that, you know, the way it comes out of the box, you know, might not be quite perfect or up to the performance needs that you have, you know, a few years down the road, or maybe even just a couple months or a few days after you get the machine. But in addition to being machines that absolutely last an incredibly long time, a lot of these systems have great upgrade opportunities. And these opportunities, you know, cost a lot less than buying a new system. They give the Mac you have a second life and a new lease on life, whether it's for you or something you hand down to your friends, to your children, to other family members, you know, anybody that can benefit from a system that still has quite a bit of life left in it, you know, after a couple simple updates. Starting with some of the older systems, going back even, you know, 10 years, most of these ship with, you know, limited amount of memory. You might be running out of hard drive storage, and you might be suffering from slowdowns. Just running out of storage alone is enough to slow down a system to a creeping crawl, and that's just due to how the system pages for the OS. Do not get too much into detail. When you run out of space, the system has a hard time managing where it's going to put those next files, so you suffer severe slowdown when there's absolutely nothing else wrong with the computer. Just deleting some files, unneeded duplicates, you know, things that are no longer necessary, that frees up space, can make a tremendous difference without having to make any investment whatsoever. Having said that, taking out the existing hard drive is not that difficult of a task, and for less than $100, you can upgrade to 3, 4, 5 times the storage, in fact, sometimes 8 times the storage that system may have originally come with. And on top of that, if you really want to bring things to a new level, a hard drive, a current hard drive compared to what that system shipped with, is already going to make a night and day difference. You put in one of the SSDs that are available today made for that Mac, and it's like a brand new machine. In fact, systems built as recently as, you know, actually as long ago as 5, 6, 7 years, just replacing a hard drive with a solid state drive, this goes for PCs as well, can actually bring it up to a performance level that feels like a machine you walk into a store and could buy new today. You know, there's that much benefit from what really is a very low cost and easy DIY. Now, one of the things that we've done, you know, with our own operation is made sure that for all the different Macs in particular, you know, we have great videos that show you how easy. And there's lots of great resources online in general for DIY. And at the end of the day, you know, it can be a scary thing to open a machine if you've never seen what the inside looks like or never done it before. But the videos and online guides that are pretty widely available, you know, really remove that fear and show you how easy it is. Like anything else, you know, it's when it's unknown, it's unknown. But you know, once you see some of these things, you know you can really do it. In addition to upgrading your hard drive to an SSD or a larger drive to take care of a situation where you're running out of space, upgrading your memory is another night and day benefit for a system. You know, a lot of systems ship with 2 gigs of memory or 4 gigabytes of memory. Maybe some ship with 8 gigabytes, but going back certainly a few years, a lot of these came with relatively minimal amounts of memory. And your system, you know, uses that memory for the applications. And over the last few years, you know, especially the complexity with, you know, Mac OS, a lot more memory is being used, you know, just by the operating system. It does all sorts of new incredible things, and it's really incredible that even Apple's latest 10.14 release that was debuted at WWDC just a few weeks ago in June will run on a system going all the way back to, depending upon the model, 2010 or 2012. So just because your system is 5 years old, even 8 years old, depending upon the model, you can still get all the benefits or a vast majority of the benefits from Apple's latest OS. And to really benefit, you might just need a little more memory. And for less than $100, again, you can double or potentially quadruple the amount of memory that system came with, and it has a new lease on life. It may have another 3, 4, 5 years ahead of it, depending upon what you need from that system. And to even emphasize further, we have customers that are still upgrading systems they got, you know, not just in the last 10 years, but even in the last 20 years. When you have something that's working right, that's installed in and with a purpose that just needs, you know, a little bit of help, you'd like it to be a little bit faster, maybe it needs a little more capability, but otherwise it's absolutely perfect. Another beautiful thing about upgrading, maybe you don't need the latest OS, maybe you don't want the latest OS. The software you have is tuned for the installation, the setup that you've already been running with forever. You don't want to learn a new OS. I completely respect that. You know, when you buy a new system, you're pretty much restricted to using what is the latest current OS available. When you upgrade the system you already have, in addition to the benefits of performance that you get from these enhancements, you also have the added benefit that the software you own, the Mac OS version that you're using, remains compatible, unchanged, and you can continue to use it. So there's, in addition to just cost savings, there's on the hardware itself, there's other advantages to keeping these systems alive. And it's green. We talk about computer recycling. When a system goes into recycling, it's really not a pretty thing. There's a lot more waste in a recycling process, better than it not being recycled. But if you can bring that computer into a position where, again, whether it's you or somebody you know can continue to benefit from it, that's about 1,000 times better than it going into the recycling bin and, you know, losing its the rest of what could be a very productive benefit for somebody. So talk about some of the older systems. You know, as things have progressed, you know, certainly after 2012, you know, those of you with a MacBook Pro with a Retina display, MacBook Air users, iMac users, you know, there's some different challenges. In particular, 21-inch iMacs, Apple started soldering the memory. In fact, Apple solders a memory in every system that they make today outside of the Mac Pro and the high-end iMac. You know, when you buy a system, just to jump into a whole other realm, we absolutely recommend on any system where the memory is soldered that you buy the most memory possible. And on the SSD side, machines that Apple's shipping today actually also have their drive soldered in all of the laptops. So the MacBook Pro with Retina and the MacBook 12-inch, whatever storage you get with that system, that's all the storage it's ever going to have internally. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The MacBook Air is actually the last holdout where you can upgrade the storage in their laptop line. The MacBook Pro with Retina models and the MacBook Air models in particular are very highly desirable today because people like the flexibility of being able to upgrade. And these are systems that might have come with only 64 gigs of storage originally. They still work awesome today. Everything else is great. They have enough memory. They have a processor that is doing everything it needs to do, but you're out of storage. And the beautiful thing there, again, is upgrading the flash drive in those computers is very, very easy. And the newer systems up to 2015, and again, the current eras, the SSD looks like a memory stick. It kind of looks a little blade, a small, it might look a little bit like a credit card, maybe a credit card cut in half kind of device. And it's something that effectively slides in and slides out of a slot that you can access in these systems with the appropriate kit. So if it came with 64 gigs or 128 gigabytes of memory, or maybe you don't know what it came with, but you know you're out of space, you can actually replace that drive in these systems with a drive that's literally up to 16 times larger, up to 2 terabyte. These systems never ship with a drive larger than 1 terabyte, even as a factory option. A lot of them ship, even today, with only up to 512 gigabytes as an option. So being able to put 2 terabytes in, if you don't know how much storage you originally had or you know, how much you need, if you're running out of space, know that you can absolutely upgrade that machine. You do not have to buy a new Mac just because you've run out of storage. And as we get into the newer computers, now certainly the MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar and the non-Touch Bar model that came out late 2016, now, these systems have become far more challenging to upgrade as they effectively have everything inside built in a way that prevents the internals from being upgraded. But the good news here, and this is kind of the wave of the future, you've got Thunderbolt 3 on these newer computers, or USB Type-C in the case of the MacBook, and through those ports, you're actually able to connect devices, connect external support to easily add storage, up to 2 terabytes of storage that runs at the same speed as the storage inside of those computers, and will bust power off the computer. So while it's not quite as convenient as just being able to swap out a blade inside, you don't have to mess around with the insides of these systems. You can plug a device in, get the same speed, and enhance the storage capability. So once again, when you figure out that that base machine that you just paid $2,000 for, 256 gigs of storage, wasn't quite enough storage for you, and when you ask how you upgrade it, pretty much the answer is going to be you have to buy a new system. The alternative is a very compact bus power device you can plug into the ports. The other thing that's becoming a bigger and bigger factor today are the GPUs. And we were really excited and continued to praise Apple for coming around and supporting external GPUs. Enhancing your GPU gives you the ability to take advantage of the latest codecs, take advantage of video cards that can support augmented reality, virtual reality, the latest games, then the latest, whether it's being 3D editing, video processing. Whether it's for work or for play, these external GPU solutions, they plug into a Thunderbolt port. They allow you to use a new video card that supports things that what came with the system simply did not. And it puts you in the position where it might be a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old system, and you find out that the GPU is the weak link. The processor is fine. I mean, honestly, processors haven't elevated very significantly really over the last 5 years. Is GPUs that have made the difference over this course of time. And being able to plug in an external GPU to supplement a perfectly good system, perfectly good computer with a fast enough processor is, again, much less expensive than buying a new system and actually often gets you way ahead of the curve when it comes to these systems, these GPUs. GPUs come out a lot faster than new Macs or new PCs for that matter. And being able to plug and play and exchange out of an external device to bring yourself up to maximum capability in the here and the now is a very powerful thing. Now, personally, I have experience with a new codec on my older MacBook Pro, and it was nothing wrong with it. I mean, the machine is fast, it's awesome, but didn't support this new H.265 format, which a lot of the newer cameras and video devices are doing. This is more of a consumer thing, but all the same, a computer with the absolute bare minimum Intel processor with a current GPU has no problem playing back this video. My older Mac, it was stalling. I mean, the processor was revving up. I mean, I had to make the window smaller. It was all because of a simple GPU. And being able to plug in the external GPU, guess what? All those things go away. So just because the system's older, just because you hit a bottleneck somewhere, doesn't mean that it's time to buy new. And when you do it right and you really look at what upgrade options are available for your system, you're often going to find out if what you have isn't going to be equivalent to what's new, it might even run circles around what's new with what you can do with what you already have. There are things that are from previous years. I mean, even machines, if you have a Mac Mini, for example, from 2012, those are highly desirable. People are seeking those out because they do things that the current Mac Mini can't do. Folks that are doing audio work, they get bogged down with, they have all the instruments, all the tracks going. a computer from a decade ago with an SSD in place of the hard drive, suddenly, you know, you go from bogging down with a few tracks to being able to handle 32 simultaneous tracks. It's really amazing how far computing has progressed. And you don't have to look further than probably the device you walk around with all day, your mobile phone. You know, the power in a mobile phone today is more power than a typical computer. A typical computer had, on average, a decade ago. And now it's in the size of your hand versus a giant desktop. I mean, some of the most powerful systems out there now, you get the power in a little mobile device. There were some big leaps in processor capabilities, you know, over the last, actually going back 5 or 6 years that are in systems that are deployed right now. And it's a few simple upgrades, and you can be on your way, you know, and very, very happy without having to go through the expense or just the hassle of not just buying a new computer and moving your stuff over to it, but also after being forced to deal with a new OS, possibly software updates, and things that just are no longer supported on, you know, something that's brand new when what you already have was great and it just needs a little bit of help. I hope this has been helpful for you, and I certainly invite you to check out maxsales.com. We have videos on just about every DIY situation under the sun, so you can take a look at, you know, what pretty much each and every Mac is capable of. And you know, I hope you're joining the fight to keep these machines out and about and doing the good that they can do. Apple builds great systems. You know, we're glad to be able to spread the word and, you know, share some insights on, you know, keeping those systems relevant. My name is Larry O'Connor, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, Larry. Oh, by the way, Larry, I just want to mention that there's one other thing you got to include before you do all those upgrades. Backup, backup, backup. Backup all the data before you begin to upgrade. That's true for updating any kind of hardware. In case of a problem, you need to be able to recover back to a working point. Marty Winston is celebrating Independence Day by doing a review on C++, and because it is platform independent, it's used for the cybernetic house that would be tough to accomplish without it. And he takes a look at several of the books you might consider if you want to learn and try using C++ for yourself. Marty, take it away.
It's a wee bit of a stretch, but one link between our cybernetic house project and that firecracker of a fourth is independence. The holiday celebrates an escape from tyranny and the freedom to make our own choices about lots of different things. One of the elements of our cybernetic house that reflects its own kind of independence is the C++ programming language. Its well-established platform independence gives us opportunities to mix and match a variety of computer platforms across the 100 nodes of our cybernetic house. When I started this project, I thought it would all get programmed in Python, but I gave up on that when it became obvious that no interpretive programming language would let us fit into the constrained hardware of the Raspberry Pi in a way that would let us configure it to survive for the target 40 years of our project. No harm done. I've never programmed in Python, so I would have to start from scratch. For that matter, I've never programmed in C, or C++, or C#, or C++. So there was something of an even footing. That's okay. I wasn't planning on being the programmer, but that doesn't relieve me of the need to understand C++ and what's easy for it and what isn't. Could it handle multi-threading? I learned that it could, but that multi-threading would take special care. Arrays? Yes. Mixed clusters of stuff treated as objects? Absolutely yes. My assignment for me was to learn as much as I could about the language without getting into the deep dive of trying to become an overnight expert. I've had experience with overnight VBA projects turning into weeks of sleep-deprived frustration. So, no, I'm not entirely absent programming experience. I needed to understand C++ enough to reasonably describe the project's many programming tasks, to break it out logically, to make as much as possible reusable, to simplify, to organize. So I turned to the top technical publishers to throw the book at me and got in a collection of C++ books that I editorially reviewed in my News Tips Bulletin and that I want to tell you about now. Each book has its focus, intent, and scope, so we judge each according to that and not by comparison with each other. Also, please note that the latest C++ standard, 2017, includes some very nice new features, but is otherwise consistent with 2014 and earlier releases. We are noting the publication dates here in the author lists, and apologies for anything I mispronounce. C++ programming in easy steps. While it is visibly the thinnest of these C++ books, C++ Programming in Easy Steps, 5th edition, McGrath, 2017, does a wonderful job overall of getting its subject across with generous use of color, illustrations, and a gift of brevity. Every subject gets addressed in a left-right two-page spread, color-tabbed by its topic. Given only curiosity about C++, it would be very difficult to even just skim this book without unexpectedly learning useful things that you weren't necessarily looking to learn. So bottom line, C++ Programming in Easy Steps is by far the most painless introduction to, explanation of, and instruction in C++ programming that we've encountered to date. C++ Without Fear. In publishing, additions involve additions and updates. For C++ Without Fear 3rd Edition, Overland, 2016, many of those surround the updates of C++ 14, the improved, approved 2014 release of C++. Updates came again in 2017, but as a beginner's guide, it covers the basics quite well. One hallmark of its presentations is the consistent inclusion of a how it works section with narrative explanation of how the just described activity actually works. This is an effective catalyst to understanding. As the complexity of topics escalate, so do the complexity of the explanations and examples. So this book works best if approached in order. Unlike detective stories, peeking at the end won't help you understand the beginning. Bottom line, C++ Without Fear takes a methodical approach to helping readers grasp and work with the principles and powers of C++. Sam's Teach Yourself C++ in 24 Hours. The premise of Sam's Teach Yourself C++ in 24 Hours, 6th edition, Cadenhead and Liberty, 2017, is that its 24 lessons, averaging 17 pages each, should each take you only about an hour to learn. The 2014 C++ updates are included in this edition's coverage. The hours, quote-unquote hours, start simply explaining what's up, presenting illustrative exercises, summarizing, then offering a quick quiz and some other reinforcement activities. Bottom line, Sam's Teach Yourself C++ in 24 Hours covers a broad swath of commands, structures, operations, procedures, and approaches of object-oriented programming and the way C++ can manifest them. But it fully compensates for the 20-minute speeds of its early quote-unquote hours by presenting later counterparts that will take much, much longer. Sam's Teach Yourself C++ in 1 hour a day. Sam's Teach Yourself C++ in 1 hour a day, Rao 2017, is one of the few C++ books we've reviewed that discusses, illustrates, and explains multi-threading. Overall, it tends to go more deeply into its subject matter, and its explanations are quite lucid. The book takes its time with some of the more complex elements of C++, so understanding develops at a manageable pace, simplifying the process of learning without oversimplifying the subject matter. The content is presented as 21 days of one-hour lessons, and we're left believing that to be a great approach for those looking to learn C++ programming while escalating their grasp of it well beyond the fundamentals. Bottom line, Sam's Teach Yourself C++ in 1 hour a day impresses us with its depth and breadth of topical coverage, and even more so with its moderated pacing to take the bumps and confusion out of some inherently complicated topics. Professional C++. The first book we've seen to address the very interesting updates in the 2017 release of C++ is the new Professional C++ 4th edition, Gregoire 2018. Which, more significantly, is a non-beginner's way to learn methodologies, efficiencies, sophisticated design tricks or traps, and finesse. This tome is comprehensive beyond the C++ language itself, addressing multi-threading, memory allocations, and many other elements of the operating platform that impact the performance of C++ programming, yes, with advice about identifying and surmounting these and other challenges. This is full metal C++ for the pros. Bottom line, as soon as your work with C++ needs to be more than casual, as soon as your C++ prowess governs your paycheck, as soon as you need to go beyond the lexicon of the programming language and into its biology, we know of no better guide than professional C++. So if you'd like to march to the fife and drum of platform independence, C++ is an outstanding choice, and one or more of these five books can help you get there. Should you run into any oppressive redcoats along the way, just give them this message from Hank. Back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeast region. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation of AVAST Thursday, July 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Thursday. Presentation is on VLC Media Player and K3B for recording and playback and some editing file conversions of audio files. July the 12th at 7 p.m., they will meet at the NYU Silver Building, room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has their meeting on Friday, July the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Princeton PC Users Group has a presentation on social media for small business, Thursday, July the 26th. Meeting time, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on drones, sensors, and what are the applications for them. Thursday, July the 26th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, August the 7th, meeting time 7:30 p.m., at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey is off for July and August, but they will reconvene in September, Friday, September the 7th, meeting time 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these club meetings are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there at one of these meetings. At these club meetings, there is a random access period in which you can ask questions. There's no such thing as a dumb computer question, so attend one of these if you have a problem and you haven't been able to get it solved. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week. The Declaration of Independence. We celebrate American Independence Day on the 4th of July every year. We think of July 4th, 1776, as the day that represents the Declaration of Independence and the birth of the United States of America as an independent nation. The Declaration of Independence is an important part of American democracy because it contains the ideals or goals of our nation.